Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 50,000 Egyptians were told still out in Liberation Square. Another million called out for tomorrow as the seventh day of Egypt's uprising unfolds. How this ends is huge. But it's huge already, too. Tunisians, now Egyptians, are announcing a new era. This hour on Point, we ask what's taking shape for the Arab world, the whole world, in the streets of Egypt. You can join the conversation. Is your heart with the protesters in Egypt? If they succeed, what will it mean for Egyptians, for the Middle East, for America? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. The whole world watching this weekend. Here's yesterday on the sixth day of protest. Those fighter jets over Liberation Square in Cairo, where protesters defied a state-imposed curfew. One protester here telling the BBC that Hosni Mubarak's intimidation tactics would fail.
I'm telling you that Mubarak is using everything now here. The order to scare us, but we don't get afraid.
We won't be afraid, and here's more. A protester talking out again against the Egyptian president.
He's using the whole military machines against his own people. This is not a president anymore. Today Egypt will be free. Or we will die here. We will live in dignity, or we will die here. The world must know this. You must help us.
And here, an Egyptian doctor in the square talking about live bullets and the international community.
The international community have to ask themselves, why do we have military planes on top of us? I'm a doctor, and I've extracted from people live bullets.
We go to Cairo now, and Anthony Shadid, he is Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent for The New York Times. Anthony, thank you very much for being with us. What's the status right now?
Well, Tommy, it's another day, the seventh day of these protests that have shaken the government of President Hosni Mubarak. There's a sense maybe among some activists that the protests might be flagging a little bit this morning, but what we found, in fact, is the opposite. By afternoon, when a curfew was imposed at 3 o'clock, there were still thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of protesters in Liberation Square. There is a struggle right now on who has the initiative between the government and these protesters themselves. The government is trying to suggest that it's taking control again of the capital and other parts of Egypt. The protesters are intent on mounting the pressure on that government, hoping they can somehow make it crack and perhaps fall.
Have the police moved back in to Cairo?
You know, the black-clad central security forces, as they're known, have moved back into Cairo, but sporadically. We don't see a huge deployment like we might have expected. They seem to be more discreet. I think there's a sense out there on the government's part that they're a provocative force, that to put them back in the streets in real big numbers will probably only make the situation worse.
Does crackdown and repression still look like a possibility or not?
I think a crackdown could be in the works, but, you know, it's hard to read what the government is doing right now. I mean, Tom, if you remember, this is a government that has basically built its legitimacy on this notion of security and stability. What we've seen over the past week is kind of the government fumbling in some ways. President Mubarak spoke the first night of the protest. He appointed a vice president. He's named a new prime minister, and there was a government reshuffle today. But has there been anything decisive on the part of the government? There hasn't. And this is kind of a threat of what we've seen from Mubarak over his three decades of rule. He's always eschewed the dramatic to the more tedious in some ways. He's never wanted to make the grand gesture. And what we might be seeing on the part of the government is a waiting game, the government thinking that it can recontrol the capital, at least restore some kind of semblance of control over Cairo, and that the protests in Tahrir or in Liberation Square hopefully will fizzle out over time.
Could they just grind down the protesters, just wait them out, leave everybody sort of exhausted, and then things go on as status quo? Or has a page turned that makes that impossible somehow, Anthony?
Well, it's hard to see the situation here returning to the status quo ante. Basically, the government's prestige has been broken. Its legitimacy even has been broken. What we saw on Friday night and Saturday morning was the collapse of state authority, basically. The army's still in charge, the army's still around, the army's still the bulwark of the regime against these protesters. It was really hard to see things going back to the way they were before. The question, though, is can the protesters keep up the pressure on this government? There have been calls today for what they're describing as a million-man march tomorrow. There's a sense to try to get as many people into Tahrir and perhaps even get them into other parts of Cairo so that they don't make too much of an easy target for the government for a crackdown by just taking over Liberation Square again. It is a dicey game, though, and it really is. We feel like these few days are going to be pivotal in some respects on who's going to have the upper hand and who's going to be able to press their demands and press their goals more effectively.
Hillary Clinton and the White House have been talking about not wanting a void, not wanting a vacuum, suggesting that maybe protesters could work with some face of the government to move ahead. If you'd listen with us for just a second here, Tony, here's Nobel Prize winner Mohamed El-Baradei talking about that kind of suggestion, saying 85 million Egyptians want President Mubarak to go, and he's saying the United States has to accept this.
The American government cannot ask the Egyptian people to believe that a dictator who has been in power for 30 years will be the one to implement democracy. This is really a farce. I mean, people here could be poor, but they're intelligent. And the first thing which will calm the situation is for Mubarak to leave and leave with some dignity. Otherwise, I fear that things will get bloody.
Mohamed El-Baradei in Cairo. Anthony Shadid, can you picture, can you imagine some kind of compromise that would leave Hosni Mubarak in the country and in control but working to satisfy some set of demands?
Yeah, that would require a strategy on the part of this government that we haven't seen in 31 years of rule. It's hard to see Mubarak taking a grand gesture like that. In some ways, if you look at Mubarak, you can almost see the Air Force officer in him, that he still thinks he's carrying out some duty, and that duty is a smooth transition. But I'm sure, I mean, who knows what the thinking is inside the very inner sanctum of the government, but you get the sense that the notion of a transition among the higher echelons of the government is a transition from within. In other words, Mubarak could perhaps go down the road if somebody who fills his place will be somebody from the old guard, from the ruling clique that's there right now. The idea of the government opening itself up to dialogue with, you know, with its arch enemy, the Muslim Brotherhood, for instance, or somebody like Mohamed El-Baradei, who has very little popular support, it's hard to imagine at this point.
Where's the leverage then, Tony, that decides where things go from here? Is it with the people in the streets? Is it with the Muslim Brotherhood? Is it in Washington?
Well, I think that's a great question, Tom. We'll take that at a couple levels. I mean, I think what you're feeling in the streets right now on Liberation Square today is growing anger at the American position. That the Americans are trying to have it both ways. Or as a protester described it to me, the Americans are trying to grab the stick in the middle. They're probably not going to have it both ways. And there is growing resentment over the sense that the Americans are in some ways backing Mubarak, or at the very least not trying to side with the protesters. Now, who emerges into this vacuum, I think, is one of the pressing questions here right now. The Brotherhood remains the only, the most powerful organized force in the country. They understand the sensitivities among other Egyptians and abroad to them playing a pivotal role in these protests, so they've hung back. But now we have a situation in Liberation Square where you have tens of thousands of protesters representing basically the dispossessed of the country, and their voices have not been articulated by any movement or any opposition figure. They're kind of unspoken for at this point, but they're the ones driving the protests. So it's a very kind of uneasy situation, very fluid situation in some ways right now, where no one is negotiating with the government. The government has no intention to negotiate, and the people who want, you know, to be represented aren't really represented.
What a picture. Anthony Shadid with the New York Times in Cairo. Thank you so much for being with us, Anthony.
My pleasure, Tom.
The sound here, people being carried wounded through the streets of Cairo. I want to bring in right now from New York, Mona El-Ghobashi, professor of political science at Barnard College. For the last decade, she's been watching protest waves in Egypt. Born in Cairo, lived there till she was 8. Mona, professor, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
What do you see going on right now in this? Is it a standoff in Cairo, in Egypt?
Well, on this seventh day of protests, it is looking and shaping up to be very much of a standoff, and here's why. The protesters show no signs of scaling back or modifying their demands. In fact, day by day, their demand is becoming more crystal clear, and that demand is epitomized by their one slogan that they've been saying for the past 7 days: the regime must go.
So what breaks the standoff?
There are two main actors right now who exert incredible leverage in the standoff between the protesters and the regime. The first is the Egyptian military, about which much has been said. So far, the military has played a very calibrated role. On the one hand, the high officers are supporting Mubarak, and he has made a concerted effort to show that he still has their support. On the other hand, The ground troops are fraternizing with protesters. They're engaging in all sorts of solidarity behavior with them. And so the posture of the military is going to decide which side is eventually going to come out triumphant. The other actor, of course, is the American administration. President Obama and his staff have been scrambling for the past few days to formulate some sort of policy. And Egyptian protesters, as Anthony Tony Shadid just pointed out, are quickly realizing that the United States is seeming to put its weight behind the incumbent.
Does that mean that Mubarak, maybe with the military, could play a kind of rope-a-dope game here until the protesters just get tired and go home?
You know, that's his tried-and-true strategy. He very well might do that, but it looks like this time it may not pan out.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the uprising in Egypt and what comes next. As protests raged over the weekend, CNN's Nick Robertson was there with protesters in the streets of Alexandria on the Mediterranean. He reads aloud here what it says on one of those protesters' signs.
And this is what we're seeing that we haven't seen before as well. Look, foreign governments, stop hypocrisy, stand for Egyptians and freedom.
And you hear the Egyptian women behind him, "We hate Mubarak," again and again. We're looking at this uprising. We've been joined from New York City by Mona El-Ghabashi, born Egyptian, professor of political science, Barnard College. She's followed it for a long time. With us right now as well from Washington is Robin Wright, senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, longtime former diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post. Has interviewed Hosni Mubarak several times, spent a lot of time in the Middle East, author of Dreams and Shadows, The Future of the Middle East. Robin Wright, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom.
What do you see happening here, Robin? Tipping toward Mubarak going or tipping toward something else? What?
I think the Mubarak dynasty, which is both President Mubarak and his intention to ensure his son replaced him, are basically political toast. And I think it's just a matter of really how long this plays out. The longer it takes for Mubarak to read the writing on the wall, the more difficult it's going to be for a smoother transition, for one that doesn't create deeper instability. But I think that we've reached a turning point in the Middle East that is profound in its history and will have rippling effect, not necessarily a domino effect, but is even going to lead people like President Assad, in an interview with the Wall Street Journal today, to admit that this is a new era.
Take us into that analysis that Mubarak, his family, his regime are toast. Everybody thought it looked that way last week, then over the weekend or today, it's kind of, you know, there's some sort of stasis there, at least for the moment. I mean, what is it that will actually bring on the, I guess toast means departure of Mubarak?
Well, I think that Egypt was destined to have presidential elections in September anyway. The question is, can he endure that long? And I don't think so. One of the big questions is going to be what happens to the Egyptian economy. It was just at a turning point. It had begun to show some economic growth, and it needs foreign investment. But at a time that diplomats are being pulled out, countries are sending in charter flights to pull out their citizens, a country that depends on tourism for a large part of its income is going to face some real difficulties. There are food shortages, and that kind of economic pressure is often the one thing that is most decisive in getting regimes or the ancien regime to kind of understand that it can endure.
Mona El-Ghabashi, of course, there have been economic troubles in Egypt for a while now. There's been crisis for 7 days. What do you see that would actually tip Mubarak out of power rather than playing a kind of exhaustion game with the demonstrators?
Well, as Tony said in the beginning, it's really hard to read this because, as you know, things are changing literally hour by hour. But again, I'm just going to reiterate that the two actors that are really propping up Mubarak at the moment are his domestic military services and the United States. If the U.S. sends any signal that it will begin to usher in some sort of a post-Mubarak successor, that could really tip the outcome. But the U.S. and the U.S. government, at least as of this morning, has not given that chance and it's that signal, and it's very much fence-sitting. I don't think that they've given up on Mubarak himself just yet.
It certainly didn't sound like it yesterday. Here's Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. She was on all the talk shows yesterday. The U.S. still kind of chasing the rabbit behind the curve, or maybe just trying to stand pat in a subtle, on-the-fence way for Hosni Mubarak. Let's listen.
We want to see a real democracy that reflects the vibrancy of Egyptian society. And we believe that President Mubarak, his government, civil society, political activists need to be part of a national dialogue to bring that about.
A national dialogue. It sounds as though she's saying she wants the protesters to sit down with dictator of 30 years, authoritarian ruler, Hosni Mubarak. Shibli Talhami joins us now from College Park, Maryland. Anwar Sadat, chair for peace and development at the University of Maryland. He's also professor of international relations, senior fellow at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at Brookings Institution, former advisor to the U.S. mission to the UN and the Iraq Study Group established by the U.S. Congress under James Baker and Lee Hamilton. His article today in Politico is titled Upheaval in Egypt, Not About the U.S. Shibli Talhami, thank you for being with us. What do you see going on in Egypt right now?
Well, there's no question. Let me just say that let's all be modest, because this is totally unprecedented. It's mm-hmm. remarkable. Mm-hmm. It is revolutionarily changed, not only in Egypt, but in the way we see Middle East politics. Egypt has already changed, no matter who's going to emerge on top, and I think everybody's going to reassess what they know and how they see the Middle East. And obviously, you know, part of it is cumulative, part of it is a changed strategic environment, and a lot of it has to do with new instruments of empowerment from the information revolution. But I do not agree that Mubarak's future is in the hands of the U.S. in any shape or form. In fact, I think the U.S. should obviously be on the part of the change and the public and stand for freedom and self-determination. But don't make this about America, because I think when you see, you know, what has happened in the past, when the Bush administration made this about the U.S., American foreign policy, going to war, spreading democracy, people's mistrust of America, people's dislike of our foreign policy, and suspicion of our intentions, in essence, led to the whole effort backfiring and tainting people who genuinely wanted change in the Arab world. In Tunisia, this was not about America or the West. It succeeded. In Egypt, it should not be made about America. You already have, obviously, people who want America to be more forceful in calling for change, but you also have people already saying there's an American hand in change and America is trying to put its own people. I think keep a low, you know, take a principal position for the people, but don't get too involved in this. Now, it is the military, really, that is going to be critical in the next few weeks for a lot of reasons. The military is the anchor of this regime. Let's not kid ourselves. They brought the whole regime to office in 1952. Mubarak's closest friends have been Defense Minister Tantawi, who was reappointed today, mm-hmm. and Omar Suleiman, who was appointed vice president, both from the military institution. The upper echelons are loyal. The mid-level officers are professional. The rank and file are highly sympathetic to the public. So far, they've walked the delicate balance of maintaining support for Mubarak at the same time benefiting from the public respect for the institution and mingling with the public. They can't maintain that beyond a few more days. And they're going to be called to take a choice in the next few days and weeks. And that's going to really determine the direction of where Egypt is going to go.
Robin Wright, let me ask you about that, and let me ask it in the context of a little more from U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Here she is on Fox News yesterday, appearing to say that, well, saying specifically that the U.S. doesn't want a void to emerge here. I guess saying that the U.S. doesn't want extremists to take control in Egypt.
We want to see an orderly transition so that no one fills a void, that there not be a void, that there be a well-thought-out plan that will bring about a democratic, participatory government.
Robin Wright, that sounds great. Maybe Egyptians who saw some chaos over the weekend after police retreated, some looting and robbery going on there, maybe many of them would like the same thing. But is that realistic? You heard Shibli Talhami's sort of lining out of the military, loyal at the top, pro in the middle, sympathetic to the protesters at the bottom. Can this be resolved? Can the Mubarak regime, as you call it, be taken out of this picture without an active rupture? Can you have this kind of, nice dialogue to fix it that Hillary Clinton's talking about?
I think it's possible, and I think one of the things that has begun to change in Washington over the last 3 days is a kind of recognition that the Mubarak era is now ending, and that it's really a question of management now. What steps do you take to ensure that there isn't a void? And I think we need to be very careful about not confusing what a void is and the emergence of extremists. That, I don't think, is something that's really likely to happen. The one striking thing about the opposition is it's non-ideological, that even the Muslim Brotherhood has said we defer to secular leaders, and it only accounts for about 20% of the population anyway, and it's not extremist. It's renounced violence, and while it may not be the U.S. preferred option because the United States doesn't talk to the movement directly, it clearly is likely to be a party to whatever happens next, but it's not going to be the leader. So it's a question now of what steps do you take? What do you encourage the military to do? We do have influence over the military because of the amount of aid and because so many of them have, the senior leadership is trained in the United States. But I think Shibley's absolutely right that it's not just one single body. There are a lot of different groups within the military, and many of them are going to end up siding with the people because they have brothers and sisters and uncles and parents who have been part of this popular uprising.
Mona El-Ghabashi, what about the Muslim Brotherhood? For many Americans, they'll feel sympathetic toward what we see in the streets there. Many will also remember Tehran decades ago and what happened after a change in power there. We saw Muslim Brotherhood leaders over the weekend saying that they would support Mohammed El-Baradei, quite secular, on a path to change. Here's one, Mohammed El-Beltagui, saying, "The Brotherhood realizes the sensitivities, especially in the West, toward the Islamists, and we're not keen to be at the forefront." He says, "We're trying to build a democratic arena before we start playing in it." But do you see a possibility of Islamic extremists coming out in control of Egypt here, Mona, or not?
I agree with Robin. I think there's a lot of reasons to be skeptical of this so-called scenario of the extremists filling the void. The Muslim Brothers are a political organization that inspires its action based on a loose Islamist ideology. They're a political party. They have many, many members. They have contested elections since 1984. Mm-hmm. In 2005, they gained 20% of parliamentary seats despite serious rigging and procedures. And they have been almost unusually disciplined in the past 7 days in the posture towards the protest. That is, they have made clear that they don't want to take over, that they will be part of a coalition that reflects the real forces in Egyptian society, that there is really no truth value to the claim that the Muslim Brothers are poised to take over, that they're standing in the wings somehow, waiting for the Mubarak regime to collapse, and then they will swoop in and create a theocracy. There's simply no empirical evidence over the past 15 years to support anything like that.
Shibley, Tommy, I want to take that to you. Let me get a couple of callers here first. Omaha, Nebraska, Ricardo is calling. Ricardo, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I think this is a golden opportunity for Americans and the American government to stand on the right side of history. You know, the Egyptian people are clamoring for democracy. It is time for us to stop the two-faced approach where we propped up these dictators and then expect to have a smooth transition to democracy. Democracy doesn't come clean or cheap. You know, it costs sometimes lives, and it doesn't come with a white glove. And I think it's time to stop the government talking to us like, you know, second grade children when they should know better.
Ricardo, we've got it. On the right side of history, you say, with the call for democracy in the streets, we've got it. I appreciate your call. One more right here. Windham, Connecticut. Stephen, you're on the air, Stephen.
Hi, thanks, Tom. I've never been so emotionally moved or spiritually moved by the bravery of the Egyptian people. Just the valor in the face of despotism and despair is really heroic to me. I really hope the Egyptian people stay strong. But besides, you know, the markets focusing on the Suez Canal and oil going up, all the rhetoric for the last 30 years has been the Muslim Brotherhood and Islamists. And it appears to me they're the whipping boy or the scarecrow to retain political power in Egypt and to scare the West.
Stephen, let us pick that up. Shibli Tilhami, certainly that has been Hosni Mubarak's essential line for a long time. It's me or the Islamic extremists. What do you want, United States? What do you say now?
Let me first start with the first question, which I think is a really important one, and I certainly agree with it, in meaning that the U.S. right now must stand on the side of the people. I mean, if we can't stand for freedom and self-determination, human rights, we stand for nothing. And I think regardless of what the issues are. But we need to also do it with no illusion. Number one, even if we support this, and we should, and there is change in Egypt, it does not mean that people are going to then embrace America. Remember, the anger with the U.S. in the region is pervasive. And that anger is certainly in part for supporting authoritarian regimes, but in part for real important foreign policy issues with which the public disagrees. The issue, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, the Iraq war, the American military presence in the region. And so just as happened in Iraq, yes, thank you for helping us get rid of Saddam, but no thank you, we don't want you. I think expect the same. Second, no matter who comes in Egypt, no matter what we say about democracy, there is a major problem for U.S. policy in the Middle East, in part because these strategic priorities, the war in Iraq that we still try to disentangle ourselves from, our position on Israel and the Arab-Israeli conflict, the presence of U.S. troops, all of these require decisions that you want support for. The public isn't going to support it, and the U.S. has been going to rulers and say, we want your support, as happened in the Iraq war, when 90% went against the Iraq war, 90% of the public, and we still insisted on getting support from governments that went against the people, and as a result, they even repressed more to keep the public from opposing them. And that's a dynamic we've got to figure out a way to liberate ourselves from. This obviously isn't going to happen in the short term, but it's a big issue. In terms of the Islamists, I agree. It's been kind of a scare tactic throughout. But part of it isn't just a scare tactic. That is that there was a theory, and up until now it was true, that in order to have a revolution, or in order to have effective opposition, you need organizations. The governments didn't only scare the public, they actually prevented any other opposition other than the Islamists, and they, as a result, when the central government disappears, the only major well-organized group will be the Islamists, and they're in a position to actually assert themselves. So what happened in these events in Tunisia and Egypt is extraordinary, because that's why they were surprising to most analysts, is that you've had massive people turnout, mobilization on scales that we haven't seen in the Middle East, without political organization, without leadership, in part empowered by these new instruments that are available to them through social media and information revolution. And that really puts something new on the table, and that's why, in fact, people who did turn out in the streets are far more diverse than just Islamists, and Islamists are part of it now. They weren't part of it in the origin, and it's going to be very interesting to see how this emerges as the situation unfolds.
Will the Muslim Brotherhood roll over those kids in the streets, you know, the Twitter faction, once this is over, if it's over?
They have been very pragmatic in the way they played their hands. They don't want to terrify people. So what they're doing right now is cooperating. They want a regime change. They will take the chances if there is real election.
Shibli, hold the thought right there. If you'd be kind enough, we have a break right here. Shibli Tilhami, Mona El-Ghabashi, Robin Wright, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the uprising in Egypt and what comes next. Gunfire there outside a museum in Cairo. We saw damage there. Military now around museums trying to safeguard those. But there's a lot more going on here. Here's protesters in the streets in Cairo over the weekend. We're looking at what comes next here with Shibley Telhami of the University of Maryland, Mona El-Ghobashi at Barnard College in New York, Egyptian-born with us today in New York, and Robin Wright, longtime diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post, author of Dreams and Shadows, with us from Washington and the U.S. Institute of Peace there. President Obama's big trip to Cairo not long after his election. He spoke to the Muslim world from the Egyptian capital.
I do have an unyielding belief that all people yearn for certain things. The ability to speak your mind and have a say in how you are governed. Confidence in the rule of law and the equal administration of justice. Government that is transparent and doesn't steal from the people. The freedom to live as you choose.
The president speaking to the Arab world. Now the Egyptians are speaking to the Arab world, the whole world, and to the United States. Let's get a call from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, I'm you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Before I get to what I want to say, I want to ask you or urge you. You've been having a series of time, hours devoted to what's
yes.
going on in Egypt. I'd like if you would have devote some time to how it might affect Israel and Palestine.
We'll talk about that in just a minute here, Chaim. Take us to your point.
First I want to say thank you and mazal tov, congratulations to the young people of Tunisia and Egypt for their courage and their spirit. They've broken a logjam that, you know, many of us have been very discouraged about for a long time. And it's dismaying to see our own government's deep distrust of democracy. Here's a movement that's rooted not in Islam, not in leftist or communist or socialist ideology, but in calls for freedom and in social networking with Facebook and Twitter.
Chaim, let us pick it up right there because there's a lot already. Robin Wright, help us understand that. Mona says, Shibley says, you say, don't assume that this is going to be an Islamic extremist takeover. There's something else going on here. In that case, we have all heard, and the Egyptians have certainly heard, the tentative sound coming from Hillary Clinton, even from President Obama. It's been nothing like, you know, a race to embrace this. Interpret that for us, Rob. What do they fear that has them so cautious in these last days?
A couple of things. First of all, the United States has always been conflicted about what its main priority is. Is it the values that have been the foundation of the United States, or is it the kind of stability that's in the interests of American strategic interests, including the Arab-Israeli peace process and the fact that Hosni Mubarak played for decades a critical role in negotiating with the Israelis and the Palestinians. And I think the administration is focused on how do you try to balance those during a transition as well.
Could I ask about that one? You call it the strategic interest of the Arab-Israeli peace process, but of course we've all seen there really isn't any peace process. There hasn't been.
It's not the peace process, really. It's what people are angry with is what they see as American support for Israel. That's what they see.
But is that the strategic interest that makes Washington nervous, Shibley?
Absolutely, and there's no question that it's making Washington nervous. I mean, frankly, it's not the Islamists that we fear in historical perspective. I mean, let's keep this in historical perspective.
Please.
I mean, 1950s and 60s, the U.S. was supporting Islamist forces in the region when the enemy seemed to be the national secularists who were seen to be on the side of the Soviet Union in the Cold War. And it's just whoever is supporting America's interests or not.
Yeah, but let's keep
it's going to be a problem.
But let's keep pulling that apart. What does that mean here exactly?
Well, there are two things. I mean, as I said, you know, I give the example of the Iraq War. If you go to a ruler and says, you know, I need to station forces to wage war in Iraq, and the public says no, and we still want it, will we overlook what they do to their own public to support us? Or will we just go ahead and say, okay, I understand your public doesn't want it? We've seen
Mubarak was willing to override the Egyptian public. Mubarak would do that for the United States.
Well, there's no question he has. He's cooperated in a large, I mean, that's one of the dilemmas. I mean, the fact is, when we look at the relationship between the U.S. and the Arab countries over the years, and you say the allies, so what are the relationships? Well, they're anchored in military-to-military relations, intelligence-to-intelligence, security forces-to-security forces, in large part because what is driving most of it is this military presence in the region, the war that we're fighting, and the security relationship related to the Arab-Israeli issue. And that scheme anchors the relationships. And those institutions we're talking about have been the institutions of repression.
Robin, I want to come back to you, Robin, right, because we began, and then, and Shibley, thank you, but I mean, it's, you began with on strategic interests, Robin, by going to the peace process. Shibley says what that really means is Israel. Do you agree? And then what about oil? What about democracy? How do you see American strategic interests stacking up here?
Well, in the long term, clearly, democracy or political change, political openings, economic openings are much more in U.S. interests. The problem is every administration dating back to, you know, to the end of the World War II, has been short-lived. You know, they haven't had the luxury sometimes of taking the long term. They look at what happens tomorrow in terms of oil prices, what happens in terms of the balance of power in the region between the various forces of different. You know, we've gone through a lot of different kinds of ideas and regimes in the Middle East, and so the challenge for any American president is to take the long view, bite the bullet, and say, okay, we're going to go through a period of instability or transition as societies open up. This is never an easy or fast process. When you look at the kind of change that's happened in the Soviet Union since the end of communism a generation ago, the reality is you still have a former communist in power. In South Africa, a generation later, the majority of blacks are still worse off than they were under apartheid. Change just takes a long time. And, you know, in the name of stability and tranquility and so forth, oil prices, whatever, the United States in the past has made some calls for which, you know, it may pay a price now, because the longer you wait, the tougher it is.
Mona El-Ghabashi, let me come to you on the question of Israel, which our caller raised. The reports out of there over the weekend are talking about Israel kind of freaking out, saying the Israeli government and military have been thrown into turmoil. I'm reading here in the New York Times from Ethan Bronner. He's quoting Eli Shaked. This is a former Israeli ambassador to Cairo, writing in the newspaper in Israel, he, quote, "The only people in Egypt who are committed to peace are the people in Mubarak's inner circle. And if the next president is not one of them, we are going to be in trouble." What do you say about that, Mona?
What I say about that is that this is a time for Egypt's allies, the United States in particular, to consider and fundamentally reconsider the compact that it has forged with the entire Middle East, and Egypt being the linchpin. And here's what I mean. For the longest time, since the 1979 signing of the peace treaty, and even a little bit before that, the U.S. decided that the path to its strategic interests in the region is through having a strong man who would preserve those interests and put down the interests of his own people, snuff out the pluralism in his own society. Secretary Clinton has a nice phrase, the vibrancy of Egyptian society.
But why did we need that strong man? Is it, as the New York Times is reporting, or the former Israeli ambassador, he says, you know, that popular sentiment in Egypt is anti-Israel. So did we have to have strong men in order to keep that Anwar Sadat peace? I mean, he was shot not long after.
That's right. And those two things fed off each other. What I'm saying is that it's time to reconsider the way in which the U.S. structures its relations with its allies. And the way to do that, the real stability, the messiness, comes in dealing with a more adequate representation of societal interests. That doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be dealing only with anti-Israeli interests. But what you're going to have to deal with is a much wider and fairer and more proportional representation of the interest in Egyptian society. Of course, it's messy. Of course, you're going to have to deal with people who may be anti-Israel. That's their right.
Mm-hmm.
They have a right to be represented, and they are not represented right now. That's the fundamental dynamic.
Shibley, I want to come to you first, a caller to Bowling Green, Kentucky. Dale is on the line. Hi, Dale. You're on the air.
Yeah, I think hello, Tom. Hello, panelists.
Hi.
I think these moderate voices that have been silenced through the terrorists and through the power and the control of power and the manipulation of the terrorism are, and this is my prayer as well as hopefully anybody who has any idea of what's best for the world, is that the moderate voices in the Arab communities and the Muslim communities are going to come out, and these governments and these terrorists and these the people in South America, they're just killing everybody. And the people are so tired and so exhausted, and you couple that with the unemployment, the thievery, and the other things, and it really doesn't matter what position the U.S. plays here, because we're not there. We'll exist when this is over. We'll take the repercussions from it. So our statements are really null and void until they have a direction.
Dale, I appreciate your call. Shibli Tilhami, what about the two big things we've seen after democracy, which the U.S. has not succeeded in promoting in the region much, but access to oil and security for Israel? If there's a new era, what happens to those two things?
Well, first of all, you know, if we have to have some patience, and, you know, things sort themselves out.
It's been 30 years since the Islamic Revolution in Iran, and it is still ardently anti-American.
Yeah, no question.
Well, patience, so 30 years is a long time.
Let me just say this. I mean, I think that I have been wondering, you know, if the issue hasn't been about us versus them and they're pointing finger at the, the West, whether or not the people might have had more success in overthrowing them, just like we see when we take ourselves out of the game.
Yep.
I think that the fact that this is not about America and Egypt or Tunisia at the core, it doesn't mean that attitudes toward the U.S. are positive, but I think it's something that we have to have. But in the end, I think Egypt, whoever is going to rule Egypt, it doesn't matter who's going to be in power, they have interests, and some of those interests will overlap with the U.S. Egypt is part of the global economy. It needs to feed its 80 million people. Remember, at the end, part of the resentment is the lack of jobs and the prices of food and the future and the education system that plugged into the international economy. The military is likely to play a role down the road regardless, because the public does want some stability and continuity, although they want to see democratic institutions. And so all of these are tied in many ways to the West, and they are inevitably going to be some overlapping interests, but they're not going to be identical, and we're going to have to figure out a way to build on those and to work with the governments that emerge.
In a new era, maybe. Henry in Fairlawn, New Jersey. Henry, you're on the air.
Thank you. I'd just like to inject into the conversation the observation that it seems fundamental to everyone's assumptions that the most important interest here in the Middle East is protecting Israel.
Well, we've laid out three: democracy, oil, democracy for the Arab world, oil for the world, Israel in there. But what about it, Henry?
But Israel, it always comes back to Israel being the showstopper. Their interests are, first and foremost, those which are, in the words of all leading statesmen in the United States, unshakable. And I just want to question that. I don't understand why, for decades now, this country has hitched its star to the interests of the state of Israel. It makes absolutely no sense, and that is, in fact, why we face this conundrum of chaos.
Henry,
right?
Thanks for your call. Robin Wright, what do you say to Henry?
Well, the United States was one of, if not the first country to recognize Israel's existence, and was and has been ever since then a guarantor of its security. And so it's not just an interest in Israel, it's actually in American interest to promote peace throughout the region.
But how does it weigh against the other interests on the table here, democracy?
Well, I think that's a very important question, maybe the key question. And the United States has deferred to its other interests, be it stability, be it oil, be it Israel in the past. And now I think because of events in Tunisia as well, where the United States took a very distinct position on the side of the people, the Obama administration is facing the awkwardness of having not to deviate from its earlier line on Tunisia and to kind of begin to look forward in a way that no administration has in the past.
Mona, the Israeli military watching very closely here. If we should have a new regime in Egypt, if it doesn't follow the sort of 1979 posture of Egypt that Hosni Mubarak has upheld, pretty close cooperation with Israel. If that changes, people are saying, you know, in Gaza and right across the West Bank, everything could change overnight. Is there reason to think that a new regime could also, or would also, in Egypt, look to live peacefully, supportively with Israel, or not?
It's really hard to predict the future, right? I don't have a crystal ball. But what I can tell you is that if we look forward and what these protesters are demanding, they're not demanding the war with Israel. They're not demanding aggression. They're making some very fundamental demands for political participation and for economic equality. That's what we need to remember.
Shibley, do you see peace on this path, or the cold peace coming unraveled?
Egypt does not have an interest at this point, no matter what, in getting into conflict with Israel. I think the question is whether it's going to be as cooperative, particularly on issues like Hamas, the peace process, American diplomacy. I think there's going to be obviously change. No matter what happens, even if this government continues, and obviously it's looking increasingly unlikely, it's just Egypt has changed by the events of the last few weeks, and its credibility, the credibility of the current government, the public empowerment, and I think everybody's going to pay more attention to it. So I think the immediate thing is going to be on what happens in relation to Gaza, Hamas, within the Palestinian areas is something that the Egypt and Israel have cooperated on. I think we're going to see change on that, undoubtedly.
Much, much more to look at here. Egypt opening eyes in new ways all over the world. I'm grateful to the three of you. Shibley Talhami at the University of Maryland, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Robin Wright at the Institute of Peace, the U.S. Institute of Peace. Thank you, Robin, for your time.
Thank you.
And Mona El-Ghabashi at Barnard College. Thank you, Mona. This is On Point.